because, you know, and what was wonderful is just seeing all these theologians saying it's so wonderful not to be forced to choose between theistic evolution and a young earth creation, that there really is an alternate position where you're not having to throw out the Bible or throw out the scientific record. So, but before we got going in that conference, I participated in a breakfast meeting, and it was a meeting for leaders of apologetics organization. And there were about 20 of us there. And I looked around the room, I said, we got a problem with apologetics ministry here in America, because everybody there was male. There wasn't a single woman there. Moreover, they were all white males. And they were all middle-aged white males. So what's wrong with this picture? But I think the thing that disturbed me most of all, they're all alpha males. And they're all... what I mean by that is they're all very eager to talk but not to listen. So, pardon me?
What were some of the organizations representing?
Well, what was interesting about this is that they said, we want to form a community of apologetic, you know, leaders of apologetic organizations. So they only invited people who would be interested in community. So there wasn't a single young earth creationist there, because they just said, you know, we don't see them as being... you know, like we're right, everybody else is wrong. They said we don't want that attitude. And so basically I think what was good about the meeting, it says we want a community of apologetics organizations that want to cooperate with one another, work together, and see one another as partners rather than as competition. So that part was good. I was the only scientist there. The rest of them were all philosophers. So it was 19 philosophers and one scientist. So you know, next time you need to let me at least invite Fuzz to come along so he can balance us out a little bit. But it also shows me that we need to be recruiting people into apologetics ministry that, quote, are not middle-aged, white, alpha males. And, you know, I'm really glad that in the chapters that make up Reasons to Believe, it's men and women. And we have quite a good racial diversity. It's not just people that are Caucasian. But also tells me we need to work harder at making sure we're representing the entire body of Christ rather than a select few. And also, we did agree that apologetics has got a bad reputation in the church, namely that we apologists come in and we argue rather than coming in and equip. And so I think that was the best outcome of that meeting, is realizing we need to be focused more on equipping rather than simply arguing for our position. So, and this was the week when Rosetta landed on the comet. I think I did 5 radio interviews just this past few days on what's going on with Rosetta. If you're not aware of it, it's the first soft landing on a comet. And they landed on a comet that's about 2.5 miles across. And, you know, people are kind of disturbed that the comet lander was bouncing around a lot. Well, keep in mind, this comet has got 1/100,000th the gravity of Earth. And so when the lander hit the comet, the harpoons didn't work. The idea was to throw out harpoons that would latch onto the comet. They didn't work. And so when it landed on the comet, it bounced. Now, it didn't bounce just a few feet. It bounced one whole kilometer. And that just shows you how weak the gravity is, that it literally would bounce up an entire kilometer, came back down, it bounced a second time, not quite as high as a kilometer, but it did come on down.
Do you find that as amazing as I do, that they were able to do that?
A soft landing on a comet is not an easy thing to do.
Because it's moving amazingly fast, isn't it?
Well, what happened is they sent this Rosetta mission, and basically it's now tagging into the comet. So it's been right beside the comet for quite some time. And what Rosetta did is it released a module that did a soft landing on the comet. So it was a little bit easier in the fact that the spaceship and the comet were traveling at the same velocity and relatively close to one another. But yeah, soft landing on a body that doesn't have much gravity is quite a challenge. It's one thing to do a soft landing on the moon. Mm-hmm. It's much more challenging to do a soft landing on a comet.
Was it done by the European Space Agency?
European Space Agency did it. And, you know, their mission really was twofold. They wanted to, because we believe that comets probably are the most carbonaceous rich bodies in the universe. So the goal is to actually analyze the material that makes up the comet. And the goal was to see if they could find all the building blocks that we know are necessary for an origin of life scenario. And there's been, by the way, previous missions to comets. NASA sent a mission to a comet where they crashed into it. That's called a hard landing. And they did that on purpose, by the way. What they did is they purposely crashed into this comet with a goal that when they crashed into the comet, cometary material would splay up, and then they would analyze the material that got splayed up. And they did find a few amino acids. But only a few. They did. I mean, if you want to build proteins, you need 20 different biological amino acids. There's almost 100 amino acids that exist, but only 20 factor into biology, the building up of proteins. And the most they've ever found outside of living systems are 6 of the 20. And they find them at parts per million or less. But the goal here was to do a soft landing in the comet to see if the concentrations were greater and to see if they could actually pick up all 20. And so they're analyzing that now. As you probably heard, the batteries only lasted 64 hours. And so they basically had 10 instruments on board, all madly working for 64 hours. And now they're analyzing the data. And they were hoping to get 72 hours. They got 64 hours instead, which explains why they said we're 90% successful. But it'll be about 3 weeks before we get any results. Yes?
Is the battery issue because I read that they landed, when they re-landed, they were partially in the shadow. Is that the reason why the batteries didn't last?
Well, yeah, these are rechargeable batteries, and the goal was that this thing would land on the comet, and that with the antenna, they'd be able to collect enough solar energy to recharge the batteries. However, they knew in advance that they couldn't recharge them now. They're too far away from the sun. You've got to be a lot closer to the sun before you're going to get enough power. And yeah, the problem is the antenna is not oriented in the best possible position to collect solar radiation. So there's some doubt that even when the comet will get close to the sun in about 6 or 7 more months. And so that was part of the plan, that the thing would be, quote, resurrected. To use a biblical term, through the recharging. However, there's now some concern that because the antenna isn't oriented properly, it may not recharge even when it does get close to the sun. We'll wait and see. Yes?
What brought the lander back down? When it bounced a kilometer up, is there any gravity? What brought it back down?
Yeah, the comet's gravity brought it back down. But the gravity of this comet is literally 1/1,000th of a percent of the gravity of the Earth. So very weak gravity, which explains why it bounced so high. So, and by the way, a fun thing you can do, you can go up to Mountain View, just south of San Francisco, and NASA has a place there where you can play with different gravities. For a small fee, you can see what it's like to be in the 1/6 gravity of the moon, or the Martian gravity, or the gravity of Jupiter, or zero gravity. And what's fun is that you get to practice how high you can jump. And so if you've got the gravity of the moon, you can really jump pretty far up. And that explains why this lander went up literally a whole kilometer. By the way, you also see the benefit of gravity. What's wonderful about that thing that, by the way, NASA has 6 of these across the country where you can experience different gravities, you quickly find out how wonderfully designed the gravity of Earth is. I mean, because we have the gravity that we have, it's easy for us to walk on 2 feet. Try walking on 2 feet with 1/6 gravity. It's very difficult. And that was one part of the training of the NASA astronauts, was to train them to be able to stand on 2 feet and actually move around without falling over. Well, yeah, what you discover, if you go to Mountain View, what you discover, you can't walk like you do here on Earth. There's not enough gravity to stabilize you in a bipedal position with 1/6 gravity. What you have to do instead is you do what's called the bunny hop, like this and like this. But keep in mind, these astronauts have got 250 pounds on their back. Divide that by 6, it's equivalent to about 30, 40 pounds. But the problem they're worried about is if they didn't have this particular bunny hop, they would fall over and they would either tear their suit or, you know, rip up their life support system, and they would die. So, and by the way, you go to Mars, the gravity is about 40% of what we have here. And that's not easy to walk around with only 40% gravity either. And with Jupiter, you've got a gravity that's 2.5 times greater than us. And you discover that it's hard to move at all because the gravity is so severe. Bottom line is, 1G is really optimal for bipedal movement. So if you want to be able to run a 100-yard dash, you better do it at 1G. Cool. Yes.
How do those gravity...
How do they work?
How do they work, yes.
What they do is they put a pulley system on you. And so, you know, they weigh you first, and then they put up sufficient weights on a pulley system, and then they got a little thing so you can walk around, the pulleys go with you. I mean, it's a bit clumsy. It's not exactly like being in 1/6 gravity because, you know, there's no pulleys on the moon. So, but you get the feel of what it's like and how difficult it is to maintain your balance with anything other than 1G gravity. Yes?
In one of the articles I read talked about an atmosphere on the comet. Is there an atmosphere?
Well, there's an atmosphere on comets when they get close enough to the sun. Now, what they discovered with this particular comet, it's got about 1 foot of dust on it, and then below that you've got ice. Comets are about 80 to 85% frozen water. So a good description of a comet is a dirty snowball. But what they discovered is they're expecting this comet to be a dirty snowball. They now discovered it's a dirty ice ball. And that the ice, once you get 1 foot below the surface, the ice is as hard as old glacial ice. I don't know if any of you have ever been on an old glacier where you kind of get this blue ice. I mean, it's so hard you can't drill into it. I mean, it's just really, it's just like walking on rock. And so this is the problem. They're hoping to be able to drill into that ice. They're expecting it to be soft. It wasn't soft. It's so hard that they weren't able to penetrate it, which means the next soft landing, they're going to have the proper drilling equipment to burrow into the ice. So
that may explain why the harpoons didn't work either, then.
Probably explains why the harpoons didn't work. Exactly. Yeah.
Are you sure it's 2.5 times the gravity on Jupiter? Because, you know, it says how many? 1,400 Earths or something like that in Jupiter. So is that because it's a gaseous planet? That
when I say 2.5, that would be assuming you're on the surface of Jupiter. So yeah, I mean, the surface of Jupiter is gas or frozen gas. So it's hard to, quote, define a surface.
Surface with Jupiter?
Yeah, that's the problem. It's not a surface like you have on Earth. But if you're just to look at Jupiter and, you know, and see the reason why, even though it's 317 times as massive as the Earth, it's a lot bigger. And so the surface gravity depends on the mass of the planet and the diameter of the planet. So it's roughly 2.5. I don't know the exact figure to three places. That might be 2.61. You can look it up. Yes?
This is probably another one of my stupid questions, but do these comets go in a certain path like that Halley comes around at a certain time, or do they go closer to the sun? Because you said we get a lot of water, or they throw off water. Does it melt and as it goes?
Yeah, when it gets close to the sun, it will have an atmosphere, because what happens is these frozen gases will evaporate. That explains why comets have a tail.
Right.
Now, when a comet's far away, it won't have a tail, because it's in a place that's so cold that the frozen gases will not evaporate. So it will have an atmosphere when it gets closer to the sun. And that's why in comets that do get close to the sun, they'll eventually be consumed. Because every time they go by the sun, they get a little smaller. And eventually, they're gone. And all comets have elliptical orbits. All bodies that orbit about the sun have elliptical orbits. But almost all the comets have extreme ellipticity. In other words, instead of being nearly circular like the Earth's orbit about the Sun, it's very elliptical, which means that most of the time it's far away from the Sun, and then it gets close to the Sun. And the goal of this Rosetta mission was actually to make measurements on the comet when it's far from the Sun, which is what happened this week, then to get another set of measurements when it's closer to the Sun. And there's still hope that that might happen. By the way, the second reason why they're excited about this mission, we know that comets are the oldest bodies in our solar system. And we also know that planets form from the coagulation of cometary type of material. And so this is an opportunity to see what the original constituent components of the Earth were like. And so that will help us come up with a better planetary formation model. Yes?
You said that initially that the goal was that you thought the comet was the most carbonaceous body in the system. Like, is that correct? I mean, that was the objective of determining that.
Well,
and then we find out that a foot below the surface is solid ice.
Well,
where's the carbon?
Well, that could be an issue. I mean, in the sense that, that's what they're trying to find out is the stuff that's near the surface different from the stuff that's in the interior? Maybe the interior is just frozen water and frozen carbon dioxide. But on the surface, they do have all this dust. And so it could well be that comets are not the same as you drill all the way down. They're trying to find that out.
Okay.
So
the other thing is that the oldest, the idea is, is that, all the planet vessels and planets are formed out of this initial dust, which I don't know if there's a lot of ice in that, in those small particles or not. But if it is formed, that would itself tell us that if it is the oldest body in the system, it would be largely made of the carbon-based material rather than ice. Is that not correct?
Okay. I mean, the current thinking on the primordial Earth is that it was much more water-rich than it is today and much more carbon-rich than it was today. The moon formation event basically eliminated virtually all of our carbon and water supplies. But what this comet research will tell us is, how did the Earth start? If we know how the Earth started, that's going to help us get a better model for the history of the Earth. But of all the planets in our solar system, planet Earth is the one that's has experienced the greatest change over its history. Our planet is nothing like it was when it was first formed. But it'd be really good to really see what these comets are like. By the way, a third motivation of this mission is that we know that these comets are these, very rich in carbonaceous molecules and rich in frozen carbon dioxide and frozen water. And the thinking is, wouldn't it be great to capture one of these comets and use it as resources to support a colony on Mars or the Moon or one of the moons of Jupiter? And so they're actually looking at it as a resource center, because if you break up a comet, you're going to have water, you're going to have carbon dioxide, you're going to have methane, and you may have a lot of other things that you could use to sustain a colony. So, and there's also, by the way, NASA has a mission planned to visit an asteroid. And what they want to do is they want to visit a stainless steel asteroid. 25% of the asteroids in the main belt are better grade of stainless steel than we manufacture in steel factories here on Earth. And so if you grab one of these stainless steel asteroids, all you got to do is chop it up to make spaceships. And in fact, NASA has already calculated that they could drive the cost of spaceship building down to 10% of its current level if they could build it from the broken up pieces of an asteroid that happens to be one of these stainless steel asteroids. And incidentally, this is not new. Here in North America, for centuries before the white man came, Eskimos in the wintertime would go out over the snowy tundra and look for black rocks, because they knew that those black rocks would be asteroids, and that one quarter of them would be this high grade of stainless steel. And so that's how the early Eskimos were able to make these knives and axes and so forth that wouldn't rust. They made them out of asteroid pieces. Yes.
So in mining asteroids, in order to recover those materials, would they put propulsion and navigation systems on an asteroid and drive it toward a planet?
Well, it's called the lasso technique. You know, go out and find a comet that you like, lasso it, and bring it to a place where you want to sustain a colony. Like maybe you could put it in orbit around the moon and just keep chopping it up and use that to sustain your colony. You could do the same thing with Mars. There's even been talk about grabbing an asteroid and having it orbit the Earth. And then you could just chop it up to make satellites that orbit the Earth.
Better not have an oops moment.
Yeah, you don't want an oops moment. So, in fact, a number of theologians have pointed out that if you carefully read Revelation 8, that could be fulfilled by an oops moment by one of our more aggressive space programs. Yes.
I have a question about colonizing the Mars.
Yes.
I know that they have a project right now called Mars One. Training a lot of people that are pre-selected for them to colonize on Mars.
Well, okay, here's some of the thinking that's going on. If we can capture enough of these comets and get the right kinds of comets, maybe we can build an atmosphere around Mars that we could actually breathe. I mean, that would be nice. That way you don't have to wear space suits all the time. And if failing that, maybe we could put a dome on Mars and live under the dome where we pull oxygen in from the raw materials that would be part of one of these comets. So, if you want to sign up for a one-way trip to Mars, they are taking applications. The thinking is, hey, people took a one-way trip on to Plymouth. So why not take a one-way trip to Mars and colonize Mars?
Are they open to nominations?
Well, what they're doing is they're... I hear you. I think they already have 1,500 people that have applied for this one-way trip. So that the goal is that when the time comes, they would select the best people amongst those to ship off to Mars. They have to have a mission funded to send people there. But they've already determined it's much cheaper if we send people one way than two ways. So, by the way, I would encourage you to be very cautious before you sign up, because one of the things about Mars is that they have these wind storms where it will blow for 300 miles an hour for several months on end. And because there's not much of an atmosphere on Mars and the gravity is the way it is, those 300-mile-an-hour winds actually lift boulders that are this size and ship them, you know, through the atmosphere at 300 miles an hour. If you get hit by one of those things, then that explains why they're saying a one-way trip. Because,
Okay, so why don't they first attempt to make a colony on the moon?
It would actually be easier to make a colony on the moon. It's cheaper to get people there. And right away you're going to know, it's not going to be, you can't put an atmosphere in the moon. So we're just going to have to build some kind of dome. And the nice thing about the moon, it doesn't have these wind storms. The other nice thing about the moon, it's partly protected by the Van Allen belts of the Earth. And so you don't get as much radiation exposure on the moon as you would on Mars.
On Mars. Start there. That's my question. Why wouldn't they use that as like a?
Well, by the way, that's what the Chinese have in mind. They're saying, "Oh, let America go to Mars. We're going to go to the moon. We know we can make that work. Yeah, the Americans have already proven they can make it work. We'll go there." But to have a viable colony in the moon, you're going to have. I mean, there's one talk about going to the south pole of the moon, because on the south pole of the moon, there's actually permanent frozen water. And so that could be mined to sustain the colony. But another way, if you don't want to be at the South Pole, you want to be somewhere else where you can communicate with the Earth, which would be kind of nice. Because that one crater in the moon, forget about communicating with the Earth. That's not going to happen. and therefore having a comet that you can break up to sustain might work. So that's part of the mission of going to this comet, was to see, is it even viable that we could capture one of these comets and get the components we need to sustain a colony wherever we want to sustain a colony. And by the way, I think the cheapest way to make it work, build an artificial planet. That way you can make sure it's designed with everything you need to keep people alive. Yes. Yeah, kind of like what they did in Star Wars. They had that Death, whatever they call that thing, the Death Star. Yeah. They call it the Light Star.
I mean, what would, in current dollars, come on, to build an atmosphere on Mars?
It's called...
How many trillions and trillions of dollars?
Okay, that is something that's actually being seriously considered. It's called terraformation. Let's go to Mars and terraform it so it'd be somewhat like Earth, with water and atmosphere and the appropriate temperature, that we could actually walk around without spaceships, and we get a thick enough atmosphere, we could stop these deadly windstorms. You still have storms, but it wouldn't be throwing up boulders at 300 miles an hour.
I know Star Trek 2 and 3, the movies.
Right.
Okay,
they've even calculated the cost. You have to figure the cost. Okay, the most conservative estimate I've seen to have an effective terraformation of Mars, so people could live there without wearing spaceships or being in these hardened bubbles, $10 quadrillion. Okay. But as I've looked at the analysis, I think they're being way too conservative. It's going to cost a lot more than $10 quadrillion. And by the way, if you... I think it's going to be $100 quadrillion.
What's a quadrillion?
Yeah, it's $1,000 trillion. So take the entire economy. I mean, I think the U.S. economy right now is $20 trillion a year. So you'd have to save up for 50 years to get to one quadrillion, and then you got to have 100 more of those. So, yeah, clearly the economy of the Earth can't sustain such a mission right now. And here's the downside. Even if you spend the $100 quadrillion, it only allows Mars to be livable for at most 60 or 70 years. After that, you've got to spend another $100 quadrillion to maintain it. Yeah, you're not going to be able to keep the terraformation. It will dissipate. And so that means every 60, 70 years, you've got to spend an additional $100 quadrillion.
The time it takes to do that terraforming is a very long time, though.
It's also a very long time. That's part of the problem, is that it's going to take you a minimum of 50 years to terraform it. And during those 50 years, almost everything you've done is going to dissipate. And so there are people who are saying it literally can't be done.
I don't think it'll work.
Well, that's why I've put in print. Rather than spending $100 quadrillion to transform Mars so it's livable for a few decades, why don't we spend that money actually building an artificial planet? Now, an artificial planet actually could be built with a lot less than even $1 quadrillion. For $1 trillion, you could probably build a fairly good artificial planet that would sustain 10,000 people.
How big?
How big? Well, it'd be a few miles across. It would have artificial gravity, so you'd have it rotating. People have to live on the inner shell. Here we live on the surface of the Earth. With this artificial planet, you would live on the inside of the surface because you would rotate the thing so that you could... And, you know, a cylinder is considered to be the cheapest thing to do. Get a big cylinder, rotate it, and everybody would live on... So, because you have to have a gravity that's the same as what we have here on Earth. That's the other downside. You could go to Mars and spend $100 quadrillion. You've still got only 0.4G, which is not optimal for a human... existence.
What's the process that they use to generate the atmosphere?
Okay, what they'd be doing is taking up some greenhouse gases, and there's some tetrachloride gas that's a very powerful greenhouse gas.
Probably poison too.
Well, the whole idea is to put it up high enough where it wouldn't poison you, but it would be a strong greenhouse gas that would trap lots of heat from the sun to make Mars warm enough to live on. and then you got to put a whole lot of oxygen underneath it.
Where does it come from?
Well, you're going to have to ship it there. So, and so that's part of the thing about, you know, breaking up this comet. Are we going to actually find inside this comet material that we could transform into powerful greenhouse gases? And then we could dump that on Mars and raise the temperature and maybe even get a water cycle going. I mean, that's the biggest challenge of any terraformation, getting the temperature right and getting a water cycle and making sure you got the right amounts of oxygen and carbon dioxide, which is why I think the $10 quadrillion is a gross underestimate. If you actually look at the technical difficulties to get everything right, it's way more than $10 quadrillion. And by the way, what excites me about this research, it actually demonstrates how amazingly designed our planet Earth is, that we can live here and do the things that we do.
That's a good transition to your slide.
Good transition to my slide. I got to get there. And you'll... last week, we started on these ice age cycle benefits. And just to quickly review, we've only had an ice age cycle for the last 2.58 million years. And there's reasons why it's only happened now. And mainly, a lot of it has to do with India crashing into Asia. That raised up the Tibetan Plateau and actually created an equatorial ice cap. You get the equatorial ice cap during the ice age. And so, but only in the last 800,000 years have we had a 100,000 year ice age cycle. And it takes that 100,000 year ice age cycle to give us these benefits that global civilization needs. Now, let me just go through this quickly because we covered this last week. Is that because of the rise of the Tibetan Plateau? By the way, the Tibetan Plateau bounced up more than 3,000 feet when the ice melted off. The Tibetan Plateau during the last ice age had about 3 kilometers of ice on it. When that melted, it caused the Tibetan Plateau to rebound, so it's now much higher. Also caused the plains of China and India to sink, and so they went down, that went up. And the melting of the ice. Remember last week I told you the ice age, the last ice age hit its maximum 21,000 years ago. And almost all the ice was gone by 11,000 years ago. So in a 10,000 year period, literally kilometers thickness of ice melted. And that melting caused a huge alluvial flood to cover the Great Plains of North America, Northern Europe, and China, and India. And so you have, quote, all this alluvial mud that settled in on these plains. It explains why these plains are so agriculturally rich today. The other factor is, with the rebound, you've got wind. And the wind blew off the Tibetan Plateau, wind blew off the Cordilleran range of North America and South America, and the high mountains of Europe blew off, and basically set this mineral-rich dust upon these agricultural plains. And so our planet is able to sustain 7 billion human beings because of this last ice age. And as I mentioned before, of the 8 ice ages we have had that have a 100,000 year cycle, the last ice age was by far the most severe. So severe that the ice actually made it all the way down to California. It's the only one of the ice ages that made it that far south. But because of that, we have this super enrichment of these great plains of the world that allows us to sustain millions of people. And the retreat of the glaciers created millions of lakes. I mean, the province of Ontario alone in Canada has 1 million lakes. And virtually all of them were carved out by the retreat of the glaciers. And because there's so many lakes and rivers connecting the lakes, we have transportation systems. I mean, the wonderful thing about the rise of civilization as human beings, we're able to use relatively low-technology boats to do trade, going up the waterways and lakes of the world. That wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for the last ice age. And then these created lakes transform the huge continental land masses from deserts into places where there was an adequate water supply to sustain agriculture. Typically, when you get a large continent, you have a huge desert in the middle. But because of the last ice age and all the lakes it created and the rivers that connect those lakes, the Great Plains of the world are well watered. So they're fertilized by the alluvial silt that was washed down, fertilized by the wind-blown dust, and then watered by this amazing system of lakes and rivers. And yes, some of you were confused last week by this word relief. It's not relief like when you take an aspirin. What I mean here by relief is the elevation difference. So here's a trivia question for you. Within the 48 lower states, 49 lower states, you won't include Hawaii, where do you see the greatest relief, the greatest difference between lowland and highland? Yeah.
California.
California. Yeah, we're the champion of the 48 states. If you go up Highway 395, 10,000 feet of relief. The Sierras are 14,000 feet, and the valley right below the Sierras is 4,000 feet. Now, when you got that kind of high relief, where you got snow and ice melting on the high mountains, what you're going to get are waterfalls. And those of you who have visited the eastern part of the high Sierras, you'll notice that there's waterfalls everywhere you look. And that allows you to generate hydroelectric power. So I imagine some of you have been to Niagara Falls. 30% of the water does not go over the falls. It goes through these pipes that generates electricity. But they quickly figured out one time they were taking 60% of the water to generate electricity. They've now cut that back to just 30%. You know why? They were making more money out of tourism than they were making from the electric power. So, and they discovered that if they went back to 30%, nobody noticed the water difference. And so you still see these spectacular falls going over that cataract there in the Canada, United States, and they're getting additional water power from that. Yes?
I wonder, looking at these eight Ice Age cycles since we started the cycle 800,000 years ago, can you review briefly what was going on with life during that time, during the cycles between them, between the Ice Ages and whatnot?
Well, let me jump ahead and kind of take you there. Let's see. Here we go. Okay. This shows you the last four ice ages in terms of temperature. And by the way, it goes, this is 400,000 years ago up to the present. And what you'll notice is that you get these periods. This is an ice age, that's an ice age, that's an ice age. And these are what are called the warm interglacials. And what you notice with the warm interglacials, the temperature spikes up very rapidly, hits a peak, and then drops rapidly. The only exception being the one we're in right now. And so what's happening until the last 9,000 years, because of the ice age cycle, the temperature was going up and down pretty rapidly. I mean, you know, literally where the global mean temperature would vary by 4 degrees within less than a century. And that does limit the biomass of the planet. And so right now, we've got the greatest biomass of that planet Earth has ever had, the greatest biodiversity that the planet has ever had. They recently tabulated the total number of species that exist on the Earth, and these would be the eukaryotic species. So you say, what is that? All life forms where the cells are made up with a clear nucleus, as opposed to bacteria that don't have a nucleus. And 8.5 million species, I think it's 8.8 million species that they've counted. And what they now recognize is that that's the highest number the Earth has ever had. But one of the reasons is that, you know, finally we have a stable situation. And where it's going up like this, it's difficult for animals to develop a large enough population. And it's also difficult for humans to develop a large population. You know, people say, how come we don't have more remains of human beings before the flood? Well, look what was happening to the temperature. With the temperature jumping up and down like that, a paper just got published which made the point that agriculture is impossible until you've got stable global mean temperature. And so it explains why we don't see any evidence for wide-scale agriculture. Even though humans were alive during this period, you don't see any evidence for large-scale agriculture. Neither do you see any evidence for a large human population. And for example, with the Neanderthals and Homo erectus, the Australopithecines, we know that all of them had very tiny populations. And one of the reasons their populations were tiny, look at the conditions they had to survive under. And so it simply wouldn't allow them. You can't have large populations of active mammals and birds, for example, when the temperature is jumping around that much.
So basically, we're having kind of the same species around during those times, by and large, but just larger and smaller populations as the temperature got colder. And,
right.
There were no real explosions like the Cambrian or Avalon explosions during this time period.
It's the biomass thing. And you know, what's interesting about life on planet Earth right now is how much of the biomass is made up of large-bodied creatures. I mean, you know, termites and ants have always had a large body mass, and they can maintain that body mass even when the temperature is jumping up and down like it is, mainly because they go underground, where they can insulate themselves from temperature changes. We were talking lions, tigers, sheep, horses, cows, pigs. No, they can't handle much of that. And so their populations were low until we get into the modern era. And so you look at all the cattle that we have on the face of the earth, that's all possible because of the fact that we have this very stable situation. I've shown you this graph before. This is what's referred to as the long, warm spring, where the temperature has been remarkably stable. And you see that both in the Antarctic as well as the Arctic ice cores, that we've had this 9,000-year period of amazing temperature stability. And it's because of that that we can have 7 billion human beings living on the Earth at one time. Because of that, we can have billions of cattle that we can use to sustain our dairy and the meat industry, for example, as well as all kinds of sheep and horses, etc. All that's possible because of this. And likewise, you can have farms that are made up of many square miles. I mean, for example, you go to Northern Europe or to Canada, you'll see farms that are like 10, 20 square miles, all devoted to growing just one crop. And because it's all devoted to growing one crop, they can produce that crop at a very cheap price. But if the temperature is jumping around, you can't farm that way. And so I'm not saying there was no farming during this period here, but the farming would have to be kind of like using your backyard to grow a few crops, and when the temperature changes, you grow different crops. So small mixed farms would be possible when the temperature is changing, but nothing in such a way that you could have the kind of organized agriculture where you could literally mass produce food to sustain billions of people and billions of animals that are associated with human agricultural activity. So let me go back to this list here. But yeah, because of the last ice age, you're going to have relief. So we see that here in California. There's 4,000 feet of relief in Yosemite Valley. If you go to Yosemite Valley in April, you see really big waterfalls going over the cliffs and dropping down. And in many parts of the world, they use these waterfalls to develop cheap electricity. The cheapest electricity you can generate on planet Earth today is water power. Wind power does not compete with coal. You know, solar power can't compete with coal, but water power is extremely competitive with coal. You literally like about 5% the price of coal for electricity. So, for example, New York is getting most of its electricity from a place that was covered with kilometers of ice during the last ice age. You know where they get their electricity from? Labrador.
Niagara Falls.
Not Niagara Falls. They get it from Labrador. There is a huge waterfall in Labrador that they're exploiting, and they're shipping the electricity all the way down to Boston and New York. Where's Labrador? You know where Newfoundland is? Baffin Island? Quebec? Canada? North America? All right, okay. Yeah, there's a place north of the United States called Canada. And during the last ice age, let me see if I can pull that up here for you.
How
here we
far
go.
Away is it from New York?
Oh, I mean, we're talking well over 1,000 miles.
Right.
So they literally, the water power is so cheap there in Labrador that they can actually build these transmission lines and ship it all the way to New York and Philadelphia and Boston. And it's still way cheaper than getting electricity from burning natural gas or coal.
Yeah.
So as you can see from this map, you want to know where Labrador is? It's right there. That's Labrador. And so there's a huge waterfalls there that are the direct result of, because in Labrador, you still got ice left over from the last ice age. And that ice is melting. And because of the relief that was formed from the receding of the ice, you get this melting water going over these huge cliffs, and they're tapping that for electricity and shipping it all the way down to the big cities on the east coast of the United States. And, you know, likewise in here where you got the Rocky Mountains, you're going to have a lot of water power. As I mentioned last week, the province of British Columbia gets 100% of its electricity from waterfalls. So, yeah.
Does this power transmission utilize a million volts DC? Because we have a similar line out here from Bonneville dam system way up in Oregon. I think in either Washington or... And they use a big DC system, so you don't lose power from radiation.
Right. Yeah, if you're talking trying to transmit really high volume electricity, it's actually more efficient to put it in DC as opposed to AC.
Is that what DC, you know, or if you don't know, that's okay.
Oh, I mean, from Labrador, yeah, they're using a DC system.
Okay.
Now, there's actually talk about using superconductivity. So if you use superconductivity, then you can take water power anywhere and transmit it as far as you want, and you're not going to lose any electricity. However, it's not cheap to make superconducting wires. It's technologically challenging, but they've actually discovered material that can transmit electricity using superconductivity, where all you got to do is cool it with liquid nitrogen. You don't need liquid helium. But the materials are fragile. So that's still a technology being worked out. But, you know, as you look at this map, you can see that where everybody lives, I mean, where do all the billions of people on planet Earth live? They all live close to where water was melting from the last ice age. And so you got the possibility of actually greatly increasing the electricity generation from water that's flowing over the rocks anyway. I mean, if you want green power, that's it. The water is going over the cliffs anyway. Why not use that falling water to generate electricity? There's one downside to harvesting hydroelectric power. It's tough for the fish who have to go upstream, so you got to build ladders for them. But one of the reasons why it's not being done, people, for some reason, like looking at waterfalls. And if you take all the electricity out of the falling waterfalls, all you've got is a bunch of pipes to look at instead of this beautiful waterfall coming down. And that, by the way, explains why Canada is not exploiting water power as much as they could, because they generate a lot of money from tourists wanting to look at the beautiful waterfalls. And so they kind of leave it the way it is. But it's there. Yes.
I was wondering if the transmission losses in this Labrador line are any more than 10%.
I don't know what the there is transmission loss, but you know, as our gentleman here was pointing out, Ted, is that the transmission loss is a lot less if you go with DC as opposed to AC.
Well, I'm just thinking if it's only 10%, that really wouldn't justify the alternative
approach. What I can tell you this is that if you're talking a transmission distance of less than 1,200 miles, it's still the cheapest way to get electricity to people. So. What's going on here? Okay, that's five. Here's five more. And we'll go through this quickly because I want to get to our text. Got to get to the text sometime today, right? So, because of the last ice age, we have warm land bridges that were formed as that ice melted. Now, there was a bridge that connected Siberia to Alaska that was 500 miles wide. And that bridge was in effect for the entire ice age. However, only when the ice began to dramatically melt from 21,000 years ago did the bridge become warm enough that you could walk across it. And it was only a 3,000-year wide window from 14,000 years ago to 11,000 years ago where you could actually walk across the bridge where you wouldn't be freezing to death. Or walking across, because you know, it's a big bridge. Given low technology, that bridge has to have a harvestable food supply. And so research is now showing that the Bering Land Bridge had wild wheat and wild oats between 11,000 and 14,000 years ago that people could harvest, and that actually explains how people got into North and South America 11,000 to 14,000 years ago. And we're not just talking one land bridge. There was a bridge joining Korea with Japan, a bridge that joined England to France, and all these bridges were in effect at an appropriate time. So when you read Genesis chapter 11, where it says that God took humanity and forcibly scattered humanity out of one locale into all the continental land masses of the earth, that would have happened when these land bridges were intact in such a way that humans would have easy migration routes. Now, there wasn't a land bridge that connected Australia to Asia. However, now, if you were to try to start in Asia and look towards Australia, there are parts of the ocean that are so big you can't see the landmass. But during the last ice age, there was a time, and this time was about 10,000 years wide, when people in Asia could look towards Australia, see an island, take a boat to that island, and once they got to that island, they would see another island and another island and get to Australia. And therefore, it would have been quite feasible for people to migrate from Asia to Australia 30 to 40,000 years ago. A migration into North and South America would have had to take place much later. But the whole point is, because of the orientation of the continents and because of the severity of the last ice age, you do get a time window in which you've got land bridges that would facilitate migration of human beings before they had developed high technology. And the retreat of the glaciers formed safe harbors. Where are the best harbors in the world? The best harbors in the world are places where you had retreating ice from the last ice age. So if you look at the... Pardon me? Well, I mean, look at Norway, look at Canada, look at you know, Russia, Scandinavia, Germany, look at Japan. What you'll see in all of those places are these wonderful harbors where boats can come in and be safe even during a big storm. So thanks to the last ice age, we got all these harbors where you can facilitate hopping from one harbor to another to trade goods. And it formed rich ore deposits. The retreating of the ice basically scoured things out and concentrated ores. So, for example, if you look at the great gold rushes of the past several hundred years, those gold rushes all took place where you had rapidly retreating ice. And it's the rapid retreat of ice that concentrated and exposed the gold. But gold was only one of many minerals that were concentrated and exposed by how aggressive the last ice age was. And the retreat to the fact that the ice melted in just a 10,000-year window generated these ore deposits that human beings can come along. So how do human beings so rapidly develop metallurgy? We can thank God for the last ice age. The severity of the last ice age made it possible for humans to be able relatively early to develop metallurgy and launch themselves out of the last ice age. And I've already mentioned this, it formed large alluvial plains where you could grow lots of crops. And last but not least, it created spectacular scenery. So, and you say, what do we need spectacular scenery for? I think God knew there would come a time when billions of us would be living together in crowded cities and we needed some relief from the stress of living in places like New York and Moscow and London and Paris and Los Angeles. And so you can get in your car or get in one of these airplanes and go to a place where you see the spectacular scenery that was carved out by the last ice age. I mean, if it wasn't for how severe the last ice age was, we wouldn't have these wonderful national parks that you see around the world. By the way, this is even true, as I found out when I visited Australia. Where do all the tourists in Australia go when they want to get away from the stress of the big cities of Melbourne and Sydney? They go to Tasmania, because Tasmania has these three really beautiful national parks. But the scenery of those national parks were all created by the retreat of glaciers from the last ice age. So that's where they go to get away from the stress of a high technology city life. Now, these 10 things is not a complete list. It's simply a partial list of the benefits that we recruit from the last ice age. But I know Thanksgiving Day is coming up. So I'm just suggesting that, Ron, when you're gathered around the Thanksgiving table, you might want to thank God for just how severe the last ice age was, because it actually makes possible for us to enjoy our Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, the very fact that we've got the metallurgy that we decorate our table with is there thanks to the last ice age, the abundance of food, the fact that we can have so many people over for Thanksgiving. Thank God for the last ice age, because otherwise we wouldn't have this. Yes.
Hugh, I think your next book needs to be all the things that you've told us over the years that we're supposed to thank God for Thanksgiving.
Well, I haven't told my son this, but I've got one prepared for this Thursday, which is to thank God for all the bacteria that are not the eukaryotic bacteria, but the prokaryote bacteria, because of the prokaryote bacteria in the early history of the Earth that actually precipitated uranium, and how that precipitated uranium actually set up the tectonics on planet Earth for a sufficient period of time that we could have Thanksgiving dinner. So yeah, every Thanksgiving I try to think of something new to spring on my family that we can thank God for. So this year it's going to be uranium precipitated by these bacteria. So
that's a step ahead of whale poop, I think.
We did that one year, whale poop. Oh, and by the way, if you visit my Twitter account, you'll see that we now need to be thanking God for hippo poop. Because what hippos do is that they basically feed at night on the shore. And then during the daytime when it's hot, because they sunburn very easily. The reason why hippos spend all their time in muddy water is to prevent sunburn. But they've been eating all night, they go into the water, and they poop in the water. But their poop, they've now discovered, sustains an enormous ecosystem of life in the rivers and lakes of Africa. And if it wasn't for hippos and their lifestyle, we wouldn't have this amazing ecosystem of life they're living in the water. So, hey, if you don't want to thank God for the uranium precipitates or for the severity of the last ice age, you might want to think about thanking God for the hippo poop contribution to the ecosystem. Well, I think this article that they just published on hippo poop, in fact, it was just published days ago, is making the point that, you know, there was a time when you had hippos in Asia and Europe, as well as in Africa, and that one of the problems we're facing in the ecosystems of Europe and Asia is the lack of hippos. We only have them in certain parts of Africa, but research in Africa is now showing that, hey, maybe we need to be doing something to, you know, bring back the population of hippos and extend them into environments. I mean, if you read
maybe we can breed some that are not aggressive and are killing people, yeah, though.
Well, if you read the Old Testament, you'll notice there's reference to hippos being in the Jordan. There was a time when the Jordan River in Israel was populated by hippos. And notice, too, that in ancient Israel, Israel was sustaining a large population. During the kingdoms of Solomon and David, there was a huge population living there in the land. But now this research is showing that, well, the hippos had a lot to do with it. So, hey, maybe it's time to bring hippos back to more places.
It's also time to conclude.
It's also time to conclude.
A couple more minutes.
All right.
No more questions, please.
Okay. Well, here's where I'm going with it. Let me just read the text here in Proverbs 8. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, before his deeds of old, was appointed from eternity, from the beginning, before the world began. When there were no oceans, I was given birth. when there are no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled in place, before the hills, I was given birth. Before he made the earth or its field or any of the dust of the world, I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizons on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and fixed security the fountains of the deep, when he gave the sea its boundary so the waters would not overstep his command, and when he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was a craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence. Why? Rejoicing in his whole world and delighting in mankind. What this text is telling us, God did all of this for billions of years to set the stage for humanity. But what I'm suggesting with this ice age cycle is that God did all this not only so that humans could have a place to live, but humans could have a large population and a technology. Why? To fulfill the mission for which God created us. And so what I'm going to be sharing with you next week is that, let me get back to this again, sorry. Not next week, because I'm going to be speaking at a church next week, so it'll be 2 weeks. But remember I was talking about how we have this amazing 9,000-year stable temperature condition? It's also the same period of time where we have no nearby supernova. Other times in the history of the Earth, we've had all throughout here, you got dangerous supernova. Here, no dangerous supernova. God has set the stage so that we can really fulfill the purpose of creation. So I've mentioned before, every major creation text of the Bible links redemption to creation and makes the point that before God created anything, he was already initiating his works of redemption. And so my whole point is, God has purposely set the scene for the entry of human beings after 3.8 billion years of life history, has given us this amazing 9,000-year window. Why has he given us that 9,000-year window? So that through the Holy Spirit, we can complete the work of redemption. By the way, I'll be sharing with you 2 weeks from now how this cannot be sustained. I mean, in spite of everything we're talking about, what can we do about global warming? What can we do to stop the advent of the next ice age? There really is a limit. In fact, I would say at the very outside, we can sustain the present climate of the Earth for no more than 1,000 more years. And without this, there's no way we can take the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. God set it up so that we could actually fulfill the Great Commission. So what I'm going to be doing 2 weeks from today is taking you through all 66 books of the Bible and showing you how God set up these physical conditions in line with his redemptive goal for humanity. Beginning with Abraham, then moving through David and Solomon, and then through the coming of the Messiah 2,000 years ago and the mission he's given us today. And I also want to show you how well we're doing and actually make the point that I think we can do it in a lot less than 1,000 years. But God gave us everything we need to make it happen. So with that, let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, as we celebrate Thanksgiving, we do want to thank you that you've equipped us with all the resources we need to fulfill the mission for which you created us. And thank you, Lord, that you've chosen us, and not the angels, to be the primary means by which redemption would take place. Thank you for the grace that you've sent our way through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And Lord, thank you for setting up this planet, this galaxy, all the life on our planet, so that we can quickly and efficiently fulfill the task that you've assigned to us. And having fulfilled the task, we can leave this creation and enter into a far better creation, the new creation you describe at the end of the Bible. So, Father, I pray you make us especially thankful this week and give us many opportunities to share the reasons for our gratefulness with those people that we'll meet and encounter as we celebrate Thanksgiving. In Jesus' name, amen.
One other quick announcement I forgot to announce is a week from tomorrow, December the first Monday, will be the LA chapter meeting. We'll be continuing on our Navigating Genesis series. So December 1st, 7 o'clock, right here in this room.